the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, a wet and wild weekend across Japan for the return of J1. The weather aside, it was great to have the football back.
Yeah, it was. It was a great weekend of action. Lots of goals, lots of action, except for at Shonan, but I'm sure you had a lovely time otherwise. But yeah, it was great to have the league back and great for the teams at the top of the league and generally the teams at the bottom, unless you're Vissel Kobe.
Yes, so an awful lot to get through on this episode, and we'll also welcome Neil Debnam back to the show to get his thoughts on how things are going at Kawasaki Frontale as we reach the halfway point of the season with the Saturday's round. But before we dive into that, just wanted to mention off the top an unfortunate semi-final defeat for the Japan under-21s, who, as we mentioned last week, had done so well to reach the last four of the under-23 Asian Cup. They fell 2-0 to Uzbekistan last Thursday morning, but they dusted themselves off and ended the competition in third place after a 3-0 win over Australia in the third place playoff. So it was a much changed team from Go Oiwa for the third place game, Sam. Obviously, a number of players licking their wounds after the semi-final defeat. But overall, and as we discussed on last week's episode, a number of players have probably done their chances of making the EAFF squad no harm. And overall, third place, considering it was an under-21 side taking part in this under-23s tournament, ultimately is a pretty fair return, I'd say.
Yeah, it has to go down as a very good result for them to get third in that competition. As you say, with an under-21 team, a lot of the players have definitely bolstered their reputations. Joel Fujita has done it more on a continental stage now. I'm sure he has played a few times in the ACL, but yeah, he looked really good in this. And Hosoya and Suzuki, we mentioned last week, got their goals. So yeah, really good to come third in that. It was a difficult game against Uzbekistan, obviously the hosts. I thought Uzbekistan probably did deserve that victory. They played very well. Their number 10, I can't pronounce his name, Jailodinov or something like that. He looked a real player. So yeah, Japan just couldn't quite get to grips with them in that game. But yeah, as it goes, third place for an under-21 team in that tournament is a fantastic return. And yeah, hopefully we do see a few of that squad in the EAFF Cup squad coming up next month.
Yes, indeed. All right. So, yeah, well done to Go Oiwa and his side. So J1 reached the halfway point of the season on Saturday with match day 17. As Sam's mentioned already, it was a good day for teams at the top of the table. In fact, all four, the top four at kickoff all won their matches, and three of them in come from behind fashion. And we'll begin with the only away team to win across the entirety of the match day, Sam. It was the leaders, Yokohama F. Marinos, who kept their one-point lead at the top of the table intact after winning away at Gunma Osaka, who were finally able to welcome first-choice goalkeeper Masaaki Higashiguchi back to the starting lineup for his first appearance of the season. And, well, Gunma made a very bright start, didn't they, Sam? And, indeed, Dawan slotted into an unguarded net in just the seventh minute. So maybe the Gunma supporters were thinking Higashiguchi was their good luck charm.
Yeah, it did look that way at the start. They pressed really hard from the off. We've seen it a couple of times this season with Yokohama when they are pressed. I think Kashua did it very early on in the season, but they do cause errors in there. They're not quite as comfortable as maybe Yokohama teams in the past have been. And yeah, it was really good pressing down, and Takeoka had to kind of get it away quickly, just go straight to Darwin, and he gets another goal. I mean, he scored plenty so far. This is probably the easiest he scored, but it was a really good start for Gunma. They absolutely went toe-to-toe with Yokohama at the start of the game, and got their rewards for it. So I think it's a message to other teams. This is probably how you approach Yokohama, but Yokohama did grow into that game, and for the rest of the game they were probably the better side and went on to win it, probably deservedly so. But there were some weird refereeing decisions in this game.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll come on to some of those for sure. I mean, yeah, Gunma could have really made the most of their promising start in the 15th minute. But the Yokohama F. Marinos goalkeeper Yohei Takaoka leapt to save Patrick's bullet header from 6 yards after good persistence down the right, and ultimately a pinpoint cross in from Kosuke Onose in the 20th minute. Sam, I'm not sure if this is one of the incidents you're talking about. Leo Ciara thought he'd equalised for F. Marinos with a fierce low drive, only for the linesman to flag El Burr offside in Higashiguchi's line of sight, or just about. It was that one of the incidents you were referring to?
No, fairness, I thought this was just about correct. He's just offside. He is probably in the line of vision of Higashiguchi. I think Higashiguchi actually gets quite lucky because it goes right through him, and I'm not sure how much of an interference there was, but there probably was just enough to spare Higashiguchi's blushes, and it did him the world of good, actually, because after that, I thought he was a lot more confident and back towards the Higashiguchi that we know. But yeah, I think this was the one maybe correct call that the referee or the linesman made all game.
Well, okay, that's good, because yeah, I concur. Actually, that was the correct decision. So I'm glad that that's not one of the ones that had you a bit surprised. So I don't know. Maybe they weren't included in the DAZN highlights. So what in particular was having you scratching your head?
Well, there was one. It was probably the 64th minute where there's a handball from Saito, where the ball bounces in the area. He's holding off El Bear, but he sweeps the ball away with his hand. It goes to the VAR official, which on the video review on the on pitch review, sorry. So obviously the VAR thinks it's handball and should change it. And the referee, for the first time in memory, has actually took a stand and said, "No, I'm not giving the penalty." And he just gave a throw in. So that was a weird decision. And then I'm not happy with the red card either, because I don't think Kwon touches him, or if he does, it might be the slightest brush. So yeah, those were the two blatantly poor decisions in my opinion. But yeah, I know the Saito one didn't appear on the highlights package I saw either, so perhaps they're just avoiding that.
Right, yes. Well, I did see the sending off, and for Kwon for a second yellow card in the 90th minute, and yes, any contact at all was extremely minimal, and yeah, certainly wouldn't have caused Kota Watanabe to come flying to the floor in the manner that he did. But I guess the referee has come to the conclusion that Watanabe was at least impeded by Kwon, and therefore the decision was justified. But yeah, definitely a harsh one for the Gumba man to take. Okay, so by the time that Mitsuki Saito imitated a volleyball player then, so F. Marinos were already 2-1 ahead, were they, after Takuma Nishimura equalised 11 minutes into the second half, and then Kouta Mizunuma put F. Marinos in front just 5 minutes later. So, again, this is a trait we've associated with Kawasaki so many times over the past few seasons, Sam, and it looks like F. Marinos have certainly learnt from the best. Scoring in bunches, and ultimately, yeah, their pressure telling. As you said, they were the better team from the early stages, maybe the 20th minute or so onwards. So I guess the way they're rolling at the moment, although they can be gotten at, There does seem to be almost a sense of inevitability to the fact that they're going to wear out teams, and it's just a matter of them taking their chances when they present themselves.
Yeah, it does look that way. If you allow Marinos to have the ball, to have the constant attacks, they are going to find a way through, which is why I think teams need to go as Gamba did at the start and really attack them, because the weakness in that Marinos team is the back line. It's not been settled all season. They've had to chop and change, and there are errors that are presented there. But going forward, and it doesn't seem to matter what players they put out on the pitch, because, I mean, Marcos Jr. wasn't playing here. Nakagawa wasn't really involved in the goals. You've got Mizunuma coming in, Nishimura, loads of different players, and they all combined so well for these two goals. Mizunuma was the first one with a cross. El Bear was the one getting on to the end of it with his shot was well saved by Higashiguchi, but then the speed of thought from Watanabe to pull it back to Nishimura was excellent, and Nishimura, as he has done all season, finished off in that position. And the second goal is glorious. The pass from El Bear is perfect. Mizunuma times his run so well, great control and finish, and yeah, it was real quality, both of those goals. And in that burst, as you say, they took the game away from Gamba, and really Gamba had no real response. They've just been kind of blown away by that part.
Right, and obviously it's been a difficult season to this point for Gumba. They have a game in hand, of course, but that will be away At home against Hiroshima. So that's a difficult looking game on paper, the form that Hiroshima are in, and they've just seen Reds and Iwata go above them in this match day with wins, spoiler alert for later on in the episode, listeners, and just behind them Shimizu and Shonan, a spoiler alert again, have pulled up right onto their coattails with their wins on Saturday. So three straight defeats for the black and blue half of Osaka. Obviously, a bright start here, and they'll be wrapped to have Higashiguchi back and playing. But, there's no time like the present. They're really going to have to start clicking into some sort of form, aren't they?
And they've still got a lot of injury issues. Obviously, Kwon's suspension here is going to hurt because Shoji's missed the last few games. So if he's out and Kwon's out, that leaves them with a real problem at the back. They always just seem to be plugging holes. There always seems to be one thing goes wrong and they might fix that, but then there's another leak somewhere. And Kurikawa, I think, also missed this game as well. So, there's just... First of all, they've got to try and find a fit team and a settled team. And I think probably, as we spoke about with Johnny a couple of weeks ago, there are a few areas that they need to improve when the window opens in a couple of weeks' time. So it's a really important period, this, for Gamba, because they look to be on the slide, and it looks like maybe the teams around them are starting to pick up form. Certainly Shimizu, you've got that new manager bounce they're going to contend that's going to be in there, and you could easily see Gamba dropping into those relegation places maybe this weekend.
Yes, indeed. All right, then. So on the flip side then, for F Marinos, it's three straight wins for them. And they, as we said at the intro to this game, they remained on top of the pile and a point ahead of both Kashima and Kawasaki. So before we get to Neil and talk about Frontale's win over Sapporo on Saturday, let's quickly cover Kashima's 1-0 home win over Kyoto. Sam, I say quickly because, there didn't appear to be a massive amount of goal-mouth action in this game. The first half definitely belonged to the goalkeepers. I mean, there were some decent chances at either end, but Kwon Sun-tae denied Peter Utaka's first-time shot early doors, and then Naoto Kami Fukumoto wore an ISA waiter shot flush to his face closer to half-time. But into the second half, and 5 minutes after the break, it was that man, Arthur Kaike, who delivered for Antlers yet again. He headed in Yuta Higuchi's corner and celebrated with a pretty splendid backflip as well to give Antlers the lead. And, well, that was ultimately enough for them, Sam. Their makeshift back line that we've questioned it at times this season was able to, keep Kyoto at bay, and any sense of a Kyoto revival that we'd thought might have been on the cards heading into the international break, that was they found Kashima too tough a nut to crack.
Yeah, they didn't really offer a great deal, bar that Utaka strike that you mentioned earlier that Kwon saved. I think it was like the fourth or fifth minute, but otherwise they didn't really get much going forward. And it is a Kashima team that you probably can get against, but they just didn't seem to have maybe the belief, maybe the quality. That just, it was really controlled from Kashima, who themselves weren't great. They probably had the better chances, but without Yuma Suzuki there, they kind of went long ball for a long period of this game, and it did break up that Kyoto defense a few times. And that was, I think, Kaike got through when there was a decent save from Kami Fukumoto. I think Sunimoto was one that was sent through with one of those long balls, and he shot wide, so it was causing problems for Kyoto, but it wasn't necessarily the flowing build-up play that you might normally expect with Kashima, and that you might get when Yuma Suzuki drops into those positions and helps with the build-up. So this wasn't the greatest game ever, but it was a routine enough victory for Kashima, and it keeps them in second place, and that's all they can ask for.
Yes, indeed. And I guess a potential banana skin against Kyoto, but they've handled that and kept up their end of the bargain in the top three, and stay a point behind F Marinos after their first win in four. The same applies to defending champions Kawasaki, who notched their first win in four league games on Saturday evening. And as we move on to Frontale's home win over Sapporo, we're pleased to be joined by Neil Debnam. And Neil, welcome back to the podcast. How are you?
Good, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me back again.
Always a pleasure. And yeah, we've reached the halfway point of the season. And well, yeah, coming into match day 17, obviously, Neil, your side Frontale had endured a bit of a blip, having gone three consecutive J1 games without a win for the first time in goodness knows how long. And yeah, having suffered back to back defeats. Obviously, Frontale have been the dominant force in J1 over the course of the last five seasons, and now into a sixth. So we had wondered on the podcast, well, we'd speculated, and we were pretty certain, in fact, that Sapporo were the right opponent at the right time for Frontale. And though your side ultimately had to come from behind on two separate occasions, you've ultimately run out 5-2 winners. For, I guess, for most supporters of almost any other club, that would be yeah, a result to be fairly happy and positive about. But yeah, I think it's just reinforced some of the doubts that you have about this this team this season under this manager.
Yeah, I should say before I start really irritating everybody that I'm not an expert on tactics or anything. I don't have any good suggestions. I just kind of think what I think. So this is all personal, and I should say that I'm definitely in a minority, maybe of one or two in the stadium and online as well. So please don't get too angry with me sounding like I'm a spoilt brat. But yeah, it was 5-2, which was great. But it was 2-2 until the 86th minute. So and Sapporo are in a sort of a bit of a disastrous, well, I don't know about their run of form, but they're really not kind of setting the world alight this year. So, yeah, I don't feel too optimistic after that game. Admittedly, it's better than losing away at Kyoto and at home to Shonan, bottom of the table, second bottom of the table Shonan, 4-0 to your sort of local rivals. So yeah, it was a very positive finish, but I mean, up until that 86th minute, it wasn't great, I don't think. And I don't know, if you look at the score, obviously it looks great. But I feel like if people were watching the game closely, like I think 5 out of 7 of the goals in the game came from like some kind of like disastrous assist from the defending team. And it was that kind of game. And I think we just got lucky that we had players, admittedly players who didn't start the match, players who couldn't sort of nick the ball or pounce on a situation where we get an assist from a Sapporo defender. So yeah, all of this is basically a long-winded way of me saying, yeah, it was a nice result, but I think it was another horrible performance.
All right, so Sam, yeah, the game itself then, from a neutral point of view, yeah, Sapporo went ahead twice, as I said. Ryota Aoki got the opener in the 28th minute, a nice assist from Kawasaki central midfielder Ryota Oshima. But then after Akihiro Iyanaga had equalised for the champions 3 minutes before half-time, Sapporo went ahead again through Takuma Arano's header from an Akito Fukumori corner with 25 minutes left. So obviously that was Frontale with a lot of work to do, but it took them only 3 minutes to level things up again through Yu Kobayashi's improvised overhead finish. And then, yes, as Neil mentioned, we went into the last 5 minutes with the game deadlocked at 2-2, and then things seriously unraveled for Sapporo, didn't they, as Kobayashi and Iyanaga both finished off their braces after some dreadful defending, in inverted commas, from Sapporo. And Marcinho added the icing on the cake deep into second half stoppage time after a 60-yard run. So, as Neil said, some of the defending in this game was pretty dreadful, but certainly a lot of action and non-stop entertainment for the neutral here.
Oh, it was certainly entertaining, but I don't think it was a quality game of football by any means. Yes, 7 goals, and it was great to watch. But as Neil said, the first goal, Oshima, but it was good to see him back, but he definitely intercepted it and played it straight to Aoki for Sapporo's first goal. For Iyanaga's goal, it's Miyazawa who plays it through to him. So that's, yeah, equally poor defending there. The defending from Frontale from the Sapporo corner that leaves Arano completely free, that's really disappointing. And then The goal from Kobayashi is fantastic, the way he acrobatically volleys it in, but it's just a ricochet up Wakizaka that just kind of drops really nicely. So at that point, it was 2-2. Neither team had really played that well, and it was very scrappy. But then after that, I mean, Sapporo, as they all want to do, just absolutely imploded. And I've got sick of them, to be honest, because they were in the lead twice in this game. They are, even at 2-2, they're drawing away from home against the team that's been the best in the league for all last three or four or five seasons or whatnot, but they just have to mess about with it. This was so stupid. I mean, yes, you can play out from the back and it works for some teams, but you do it with a purpose. For this third goal, they were just passing it so casually as if they're out at the park on a Sunday afternoon. And yeah, of course they were going to be pressed. And the goalkeeper has it. He must see that Marcinho and Damian and others are closing in on him. But he gives the ball to Okamura, who's got he can do nothing with it because Marcinho is immediately on him. And yeah, it's just scrappy. And then Kawasaki scored. The fourth goal, Arano with the one of the worst crossfield passes. I don't know what he was trying to do, but he completely skewed the ball to Kobayashi. It puts Kawasaki in again. That was just dreadful. And then Sapporo, they're never going to just damage limitation, are they? Launch a free kick up. Nobody's back as Kawasaki counter. Marcinho runs away. Very nicely taken goal. But yeah, just Sapporo once again shooting themselves in the foot in a game that they were very much in and maybe could have won. But yeah, it's just a good win eventually, I suppose, for Kawasaki, but I can understand why Neil still has a few doubts over this. And yeah, Neil, you mentioned you weren't necessarily a tactics guy, but how would you have put that team together when you saw the 11 names there? Because it was a weird concoction of players.
Yeah, I had a few guesses at it, and the one guess that I thought was perhaps the most ridiculous one was the one that turned out. I mean, I think at the end of the Shonan game, I think Oniki had played three at the back with Yamane, must have been Taniguchi and Kudamaya, I guess. And it looked like that from sort of the players that were listed. But then sort of if that were the case, I wasn't sure what was going to go on in midfield either. But of course, Oniki's had, like, how many weeks is this international break been? 3 weeks or something to sit at home with his magnet board, and we were speculating he's probably got one in every room, and he's I don't know, maybe one fell off the table or something like that, and all the magnets got messed up in the wrong place, but accidentally he picked that one up and took it and made the starting lineup on that basis. Because I mean, there's absolutely no reason to play Tachibanada at left back. He's done all right at right back on occasion. But the problem is we have Sasaki on the bench who can play there and hasn't had a great run recently, but that's because he's in his first season and he's been totally relied on to cover that position, because we've got a left back who's now a centre back because we haven't got any centre backs, and we didn't get any centre backs even though one of our centre backs was going to be out for 6 months or something. And it just seems like all of these problems have been sort of there for probably a year, I'd say, and every year in the transfer, you know, off the off season, the defensive issue never gets sorted out. It's always instead, oh, we're gonna transform a midfielder into a defender or something like that, and it's immensely frustrating. And of course, Chanatip on the left as well. I mean, honestly, what has Oniki been doing in this international break? Because he hasn't come up with any new ideas. He played the same formation pretty much, but reverted Chanatip back to the left side up front, which hasn't worked. It really didn't work at the start of the season. And Chanatip started playing a bit better. And was sort of starting to get into the groove of things when he got injured and when he'd been moved sort of more centrally. And it's kind of bamboozling, really, if that's a good explanation. I don't know, but it's just, I honestly didn't have a clue. I had a few ideas, and I think Alan Gibson got it, that Tachibanada was going to play left back. But it's just like, why are you doing this? We've got players who can play in the right position. And Oniki's idea of rotation seems to be just play some players out of position and leave some players who have been doing well on the bench. I mean, this is a massive rant, but in sort of recent time, the only decent attacking threat in the last three or four games has been Marcinho. So, of course, he was dumped onto the bench. I mean, and in this game, Kobayashi scored twice, but Kobayashi probably wouldn't have been on to the 85th minute if Chinen hadn't got injured. It's just like, I mean, I know he needs to try new things to get us out of a slump, but I don't know why he's trying these things. It's just, like I said, I'm not a tactics guy, but I can sometimes notice when things look really, really weird.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I read your blog post after the Sapporo game, Neil, and I mean, you certainly don't spare your thoughts. You lay everything out there, and you're certainly not a fan of the way the manager has gone about things in recent times. And I'm sure you can appreciate this. You know, there's 15 other teams that would love to be in the position that Frontale are in this season, and the fact that, yeah, you've won four out of the last five titles. I mean, just for you personally, I worry that you haven't enjoyed that as much as you might have done, because everybody's frustrated with their team and their manager at certain points of a season. But yeah, you're still second. You're a point behind the team who are on top of the table, and as you said yourself, you don't want to come across as like a spoiled brat or anything, but I mean, I don't know, maybe you're starting to realize how the rest of us feel. You've had it so good for so long that if things aren't going as swimmingly as they have done in the past few years, then maybe this is the exact sort of period that Frontale have to work through if they're going to find their way to the top of the pile again. So we did put out a feeler for questions on Monday morning, and it had been a while. So I think a number of our patrons had questions are pent up that they wanted to release, and it just so happened that you were the guest, and you were going to bear the brunt of a number of them, Neil. So we'll try and work through them in I'm not so sure what sort of order, but you've said yourself you're not a master tactician, and well, clearly we don't think Toru and Nikki is one either, but from Naoya, Neil, what would you do to shake up Frontale and put a stop to their apparent stagnation? Naoya is of the Frontale persuasion as well, so he says for him there was enough promise in the Consadole match to feel encouraged going forward. He mentions five league goals for the first time this season, and the returning Ryota Oshima playing the full game. But he says that, yes, obviously he's read your blog post because he knows that you have some other ideas about the overall game and the performance. So we've mentioned a number of times that the players that have left the club, and obviously Jeziel is still to return from his long-term injury at centre-back. So with the horses he's got at his disposal, what could Oniki do to brighten things up, do you think?
this is when I'm moaning in the pub afterwards about saying, oh, Nicky's got to go, he hasn't got a clue. People say, so who will you put in then? And it's like, I don't know. But I don't know. I don't want it to come across like I hate Oniki, because he's obviously done great things for us, but stagnation is definitely the word. And I just really want him to do something different, and I don't know what that different thing is, but I think it's not necessarily a problem with the players we've got. Obviously, they're not as good as in recent seasons because we've lost a lot of good players, but I just feel like there's the approach somehow. I mean, I don't know tactics, but it just seems like we had a lot of possession in this game, but a lot of the possession was quite similar to Sapporo's possession, like playing it from the keeper to centre-back, back to the keeper, to another centre-back, and then occasionally break into the other half and then just play it back to the keeper again. It's just like pointless possession. And like, I don't know, it's like every time we have a free kick, we won't take a free kick and like put the ball in the box. We always play it short. And I just think we need to do something a little bit different and just like, I don't know, pump it in there and see if someone can head it. instead of just basically, I mean, it's a complete waste of time with the free kicks. You just allow the opposition time to set up their defence and carry on from where you were at a sort of a disadvantage. So, I mean, yeah, what would I do? I mean, there's so many, we've got such an unbalanced squad, but I think, yeah, like I said, I think the players are good. I think this is kind of the frustrating thing, that I think if Onyeki would just stop being so conservative, and that's what it seems to me, that he's terrified of losing, and sort of the two losses that we had sort of heightened that feeling. I mean, it's just, I mean, the fact that we have shots but we can't hit the target is a bit worrying. And of course, I can't blame him personally for that. It's down to the people who are having the shots. But there's just, it seems like there's something not quite right behind, not saying there's bad things happening behind the scenes, but it's like a spontaneous loss of confidence all the way across the squad, which obviously would come from these kind of awful results. But I would just wonder if maybe some of the players are thinking maybe he doesn't know what to do, how we can get out of this. But I mean, perhaps winning a game and scoring five is going to give us a boost. But I mean, I just can't really see that. It's, I think, you know, Wednesday we've got Verdi in the Emperor's Cup, and then Saturday Jubilo at home in the league. And we really struggled against Jubilo away. And I don't think we've really done anything good. Well, I was going to say since then, but I mean, I don't think we've done anything particularly exciting this year. And like, I really respect Naoya's opinion, because he knows a lot more than I do about these things. But it's just those, yeah, we scored goals, but I mean, we were given the chances. I just couldn't see us making particularly so many good chances if it wasn't for such a generous opposition. So I don't know. It's like, I feel like this year is mainly a sort of story of us getting really lucky and winning sometimes. Sorry, that was the FC Tokyo game. Or we lose deservedly, and we are never unlucky and lose. We never play well and get sort of unlucky rub of the green. We're getting luck, and we're still not doing particularly well. And yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know. Play one of the goalkeepers up front. That's my solution, I think. So.
Well, we did get some questions about a number of players in the squad, in particular, Neil, and maybe Sam, you can chime in here as well, because you know, a couple of people wondering about Tatsuki Seko, that we mentioned numerous times throughout the season. He hasn't really gotten a chance. Well, he hasn't at all. Has he gotten a chance to establish himself here after impressing for Yokohama FC last season? Kang says he looked really good for Yokohama FC last year, and he was quite excited when Frontale got him. He thought it was a very smart move, but he hasn't gotten a look in at all. Do you think it's a case of the player not fitting the tactics or something else behind the scenes? And I guess along similar lines, and Neil, you've already mentioned Chanatip. Kang says he's had some decent games on and off, but he feels like Onyeki hasn't settled on what Chanatip's best role should be, as you've said yourself. Is there indeed a role for Chanatip in the Frontale system at all? I don't know, Sam, do you want to take those first two those two players first before we throw it back to Neil?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Seko's an interesting one. You'd have thought Onyeki has a plan for him. He's obviously played so well at central midfield last year for Yokohama, but he's kind of played it right back when filled in on the odd occasion that Yamane has been given a rest or has not been available. But the problem I think he has is he's come into the area of the pitch where Frontale is still the strongest, and yeah, they've had injuries there, but you've still got Wakizaka, Chanatip should play there, Oshima, Zhao Schmidt, theoretically Sukugawa, Kosuka, lots of good options there, and maybe it just hasn't shown it on the training field. But yeah, he's just barely been given an opportunity. Chanatip is always going to get a chance, but this, he's a number 10 and Kawasaki don't play a number 10, which is the biggest issue. It's just like they had a lot of money or a bit of money come in and just thought, oh, who do we get? Who do we get? He's the best player. He's the best one. We'll bring him in, even though he doesn't quite fit the system. And they've not tried to adapt the system to fit him either. They've tried him out on the left wing. It's never worked. They've tried him in one of those more number eight positions, but he's too far away from the striker to really make an impact in the game. So I think he had got a little bit better prior to his injury and he's trying to adapt to the team, but I think a little bit more could be done to really facilitate that and really get the best out of Chanatip. But yeah, he hasn't really done that, and yeah, he's got various issues. Obviously this all fits into midfield, and I think there was Harry Brooks had a question, Neil, about the formation of the midfield and what you would do with that. Obviously you've got a lot of players there. Would you be looking to maybe loan some out, so sell some, like what, yeah, how would you arrange that midfield and what would you say would be the best way to go forward with Kawasaki if you're going to stick to a midfield three, or would you like to see it switched up to maybe get the best out of some of those players in there?
Blimey. I can't see us loaning or selling anyone really, because we just always seem to have like three or four players in the squad who will never get anywhere near the starting lineup or even the bench, even in an Emperor's Cup game. So I don't think we'll loan anyone out. And at the same time, I don't particularly think we'll get anyone in because, I mean, unless it was a defender, I mean, that might not be a bad idea. But I don't know. I mean, it's like there is definitely something wrong with that formation that it stopped working. I mean, it was working with Mitoma, but then like the second half of last season was a bit of a drudge, a grind really, and we've just started in the same way, or we've done the same thing for the first half of this season. So I mean, it does seem, sort of talking, going back to Seko, it seems like players that we sign, and I'm never really sure if it's Oniki has anything to do with the signings, because every time we get someone, it seems like, even if they've got a big name, they spend sort of at least half a season or a whole season sort of slightly getting a look in, but not really. And then the second season, they get a chance. Like, I mean, I know Kozuka and Sukugawa, as much as I love them, they're not going to be sort of first name on the team sheet ever, really, in our squad. But they did almost nothing last year, and then got a few games at the start of this year, perhaps due to injuries, but sort of with rotation as well. And it seems like everyone in their first year always gets a bit of the cold shoulder, but I don't understand why that is, and this is not really helping with what we should do, but change something, I think, is the answer. But yeah, I don't know, the front isn't working either, is it? I don't think that. Sort of Damian, people have sort of said that he's really dropped off, but I can't really remember him having many chances, if even. So I feel like people are being a bit harsh on him. Obviously, it's not going like it was last year for him, but yeah, there's something like, I mean, Ian Arthur, just flitting from point to point here. But Ian Arthur did really well from the break. I think he played pretty well on Wednesday, I thought, but he's had some really dodgy games. And I mean, Yamane, and now he's a defender, so I'm not even talking about a striker and a defender when you ask me about the midfield, but it's just, I just feel like some players play all the time regardless of how they're playing, their condition, their sort of the heavy schedule. And Yamane and Inaga and sort of Wakizaka to a certain extent at the start of the season were just always in there. And sort of it was really restricting what we could do, how we could change things. And I don't know, we've got like Kobayashi, Damian and Chinen, who all would want to play in that one spot in the middle. And Oniki's been trying to give Chinen and Kobayashi some time when Damian's playing by putting them on the left or the right, but that doesn't really suit them either. So I mean, I know he's got a hard job and I know he's trying, but yeah, I don't have any better suggestions, but I'm an English teacher, I'm not a football manager, so I mean I wouldn't ask him Oniki for suggestions for my classes, because my classes are absolutely perfect. No, I mean, I'm basically saying I haven't got a clue, and I really want him to somehow turn things around, but every week passes, it seems less likely that it's going to happen, and he seems more stuck in his sort of conservative don't lose at any cost ways, and that's not so good when we're losing.
Well, yes, having to get used to that feeling again, it must be a bit strange, I presume, Neil. But yeah, as we've said, still just a point off the top, so it's yeah, still a long way to go. And well, we'll see if Mr. Onicki can freshen things up, turn things around. When it comes to Leandro Damião and his season so far, well, it just depends who you listen to, because Harry says he started the season slowly, while Poudini says he's been awful. So he obviously set the bar pretty high for himself last season with his Player of the Season campaign and share of the Golden Boot, of course. Things have not gone as well for him this year. I'm sure he'd be the first to agree there. But as you say, Neil, yeah, he hasn't received the same sort of service that he was accustomed to throughout last year, or for most of the campaign. And yeah, that's another thing that the club is going to have to try and sort out on the pitch, and indeed on the training ground. And Harry mentions Kobayashi's durability issues as well. So obviously when he's fit and firing, he's capable of a display like he put on off the bench on Saturday for the last half hour. But yeah, it's hard to rely on him too much these days. So yeah, well, Harry wonders whether the club might need to go into the market for a forward. I guess, Sam, there's probably enough names on the books for them to be able to muddled their way through, unless they really wanted to make a splash. But I'm not really sure that the summer, and yeah, betting someone in to Toru Aniki's system, as we've just heard, it can take players a long time to earn the manager's trust and to get a constant role in the team. So maybe this would not be the sort of thing that they would need to do, because it might just disrupt things even more.
Yeah, I don't think striker necessarily is the way they should go if they are going into the window this summer. I mean, Damian is a very good player. Just play to his strengths a bit more, create more chances, go forward with more intensity. Stop playing this very conservative, ultra tippy-tappy, pass it around, we'll keep possession for ages. We might get 80% possession by the end of the game, but haven't really gone anywhere. Just get the ball into the box to him. You saw, I don't want to bring the Tokyo game up again, but it's just balls into the area. I mean, it's so good in the air, just give him something to work with, and they really haven't for most of this season. So I think, yeah, just play him. Kobayashi, as you saw at the weekend, very good option off the bench. You've got Tono, you've got Chinen, you've got Marcinho. There are lots of options there. If they're going anywhere, centre-back, for goodness sake. Maybe Jesse L is going to come back in the next few weeks, but he's still been out for a long time. So you really need someone to take the load off him occasionally. You've still got Yamane plays every minute of every game. You need someone just to give him a little bit of a breather. He just needs some options at the back there, because you end up in a situation where you're playing your holding midfielder at left back, and that shouldn't be the case. So if you're going to make a change, I think it's there. But generally speaking, there is still a very good squad there. Yes, they've lost a lot of good players over the last couple of years, but still, if you put that first 11 out against anyone in the league, I'd say it was the best 11 there. So yeah, just needs to be harnessed, just need to play a little bit more to their strengths, and I'm sure they can do that. It's just whether Onicki is willing to, and unfortunately the formation he picked for this game doesn't suggest it, and because they've won 5-2, I imagine they'll stick with a similar way of playing in the next game against Jubilo, and they will cause them more problems, because Jubilo are going to sit in, they're going to make it more difficult, and they're not going to do what Sapporo do and just give away goals for free.
yes indeed. All right, well, Neil, I wonder if you've calmed down slightly from the time when you were putting together your blog post after the Sapporo game, because in that post towards the end you declared the title was gone. a point behind with 17 to play. So some might call that jumping the gun. I'm not sure, but Poudini asks, do you still see a title on the horizon this season? I think, as Sam's just outlined there, I mean, it's still a squad packed with quality. You clearly have your frustrations about the way the manager is piecing these together these days, and you're hoping for things to be refreshed, and not necessarily the personnel, but maybe the way they're employed and the football that they actually put on display for you. So I don't know. Are you prepared now to slightly backtrack and say that the title is still a possibility for Frontale this season?
I'll fudge my answer a little bit by saying I think the title's gone because I think he won't change. But if he changes, if he listens to Sam, I think we can do it. But it's just, I mean, I can't see Marinos and Kashima losing as much as we will for the rest of the year, and they're already, both of them are already ahead of us. So I can't see it unless he makes a big change. I'm going to stand by what I said earlier, admittedly with a massive caveat, but I think it's gone. I think it's gone, and it's kind of ruined the possible succession plan, because in my mind I imagined that Moriyasu would mess up the World Cup first. I don't know why I get that feeling. It's got a tough group, but I think he would like mess it anyway. And then Oniki would be in perfect position to just slide into that job, and then everybody's happy. But I just worried that he's messing up his reputation, and we might people are going to hate me for saying this, and we might be stuck with him again next year. The most successful manager in our history. But I don't know if it's sickening hearing me say this, I guess. But I don't know. It's just, it's not fun anymore. And it's supposed to be fun, isn't it? I know we can't win forever. And I knew that it was going to come to an end. But for it to come to an end with like such good talent available and just being misused, it's just, it's a real shame. Yeah, it's gone.
Well, all right then. Well, some would say, most would say, almost everybody would say that there's still a long way to go, and this team with its championship DNA is still well and truly in the thick of things. But we can see where you're coming from after the highs that your team has hit in the last five seasons. Well, four out of the last five, obviously, an unprecedented run of success in J1 history. When things are maybe starting to turn, then as I said earlier on, I just hope that you've been able to enjoy it as much as you should have done, because as I said, no team has ever done anything like this in the history of J1 before. So maybe just before we let you go, I mean, there's a question from Johnny Nickel that it could be an entire podcast in and of itself, but Johnny's wondering about the overall level of the league. Neil, Frontale have now played everybody once. We can all see in terms of the raw numbers, the points total, that Frontale are not as dominant as they have been in their championship seasons. Well, at least the last three of them, obviously the first one went right down to the wire against Kashima. But have you noticed an overall increase in the level of the league that maybe has helped to peg Frontale back, or is it fairly level as usual, and Frontale's levels have just slipped, and that's the reason for coming back to the pack somewhat? Have you noticed an overall improvement of the standard?
Yeah, I think a bit. I think people are like Marinos and Kashima seem to be less likely that they'll throw in one of their one of Marinos' usual disaster performances. So I mean, I guess that means they've got better. I think, I mean, obviously, teams are, it's definitely a lot closer this year. I mean, obviously, from the points, I know. What a genius. But I mean, like, the teams seem to be more matched. But then when you think about teams who really should be up there as well, who are just playing terribly, like Vissel Kobe. I mean, I don't want to pour more. I think I do want to pour more misery on them. Sorry, Alan. It's just, nobody likes a big money team. But they should be a good team. So maybe it's just the usual J-League magic, really. I mean, Urawa as well should probably be much higher. So is the standard higher, or are the, I don't know, maybe teams are more evenly matched because the sort of the explosive power of certain teams has people have worked out how to play against that, and that's certainly true about teams who are playing us now. I mean, it seems people have come with a plan, and it's usually quite an effective one. So, yeah, what have I said? Yes and no, I think I said, as usual.
Well, I mean, it is a tricky question to answer because, as you say, a number of the bigger clubs who were expected to challenge have been far worse than we'd expected. So on those sort of terms, then, those teams have been weaker. Is that because they've not been prepared enough, or is that because other teams have ambushed them, or the overall level in mid-table is slightly higher, and games that those sort of teams might have squeaked a win in last year or the year before, they're not able to do that anymore. So I mean, it's difficult to draw any sort of concrete conclusion, isn't it, Sam? But I mean, how would you go about tackling Johnny's question about the overall level of the league through the first half of the season?
Yeah, I'd say we've lost a little bit at the top. Obviously, Kawasaki are weak, and they've lost some very good players. They're obviously going to be weaker. I think Marinos, even though they're top of the league, I think they're still weaker. Thiago Martins is a massive loss for them. They are so dodgy at the back. Teams haven't necessarily taken as much advantage of that as they maybe could have, but I think they're definitely weaker, and obviously they've lost to Maida, the top goal scorer from last season. So I think they're a little bit weaker. And obviously what's happened to Kobe, they're clearly weaker this season. Reds have been as well. But to balance that out, I think we've lost a lot of dross at the bottom as well. Like the teams like Oita, Sendai, Yokohama, they were really poor last year. There were teams that we thought were going down from maybe like five or six games in, and that's where they stayed all season. So I think the overall level of like the mid-table and down is a bit stronger, so you're not going to have many easy games, which is also taking a few points off the top teams, and I think they've lost a little bit of quality. So I think it makes the league as a whole more interesting, but I think Cesare is a real proponent of this, that the league needs a one dominant team, that Kawasaki had been for a while, and like they set the standard for it, but it just hasn't happened. I think it's the way that the league is always going to be, and that if a team really excels, Europe just takes all their players. So I think Japan, the J-League at the moment is in that stage where a lot of the good players have gone, and there's a little bit of a rebuild at the moment. So I think the top, while it's really exciting, I think the league is generally weaker, but there's very few easy games, which makes the league really compact. As you can see, 9th down to 17th is separated by 4 points. And I think that's just the way it's going to be. There's going to be such a small gap between, like, even you look up the table, Tokyo are in 7th. I don't want to put you in a relegation battle here, and I'm not taking a stab at you, but I don't think there's a massive amount of difference between the likes of Tokyo, and then you go down, you've got Gamba in 15th and whatnot. So I think it's just a more even league. So whether the quality is a little bit more spread, and I don't really know. You can argue it various different ways, but I'd say slightly weaker at the top. But yeah, the bottom, the dross has been cut off.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, well, thanks, guys, for your answers there. And thanks, Johnny, for the questions. Also, thanks to Naoya, Pudini, Kang, and Harry for their questions here. For Neil, we'll be hearing from Pudini and Harry with some more questions later on. Thanks for your input, guys. And Neil, thank you very much for joining us again. I hope this therapy session was beneficial for you. And I hope that Frontale can do the business in the Emperor's Cup on Wednesday night, and at home against Iwata on Saturday to maybe help you calm down a bit and restore your faith in your boys, because I think most of us can see that you're still in it, even though things haven't gone as well as you would have liked so far. So thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to catching up with you again throughout the rest of the season.
Thanks for having me, and it's always good to talk, isn't it? So let it out, that's the best way. So thank you for that. You can send me my invoice later, and I'll pay you for this therapy session.
Welcome back. So resuming our review of Match Day 17, and next we'll head to the Hitachidai Stadium in Kashiwa, where, yeah, two teams to say that they've, well, defied expectations in the first half of the season is a massive understatement, of course. So most experts had Reysol going down this year, while Kobo were expected to challenge for the title, if not at least an ACL spot. And, well, yeah, the roles have been completely reversed at the halfway point of the season. And Reysol stayed in fourth after a 3-1 home win over Vissel. They had to come from behind to do it, Sam, and were VAR assisted. I guess, yeah, when it rains, it pours, and it certainly did on Saturday. And that's just not an analogy. That's just the way things have been going for Kobe pretty much all season. It just, once again, it just wasn't their day.
No, it really wasn't. They'd started fairly well and got in front. It was a very well-worked goal with Sakai, Iniesta, Muto, that trio, which could blossom into a very good little partnership, as Furuhashi did when he was part of that. They were involved. Sakai then reverses it to Hashimoto. A really good finish, and it looked like things were picking up for Vissel. I mean, yeah, it was going well, but then Kashiwa, to their credit, they fought back well. The goal they scored, the equaliser, is so good. Mitsumaru with the cross, Koyamatsu brings it down so well out of the air, touches it back, and then Shihashi, his finish, absolutely beautiful, bending into the corner. But yeah, after that, obviously the big turning point in this game is the penalty that was given to Kashiwa. It is one of the more baffling, not quite the most baffling, certainly not in this episode as we'll come to, but it's one of the most baffling decisions I've seen. Toshima and Kikuchi, they both go in for the ball. Maybe Toshima slightly jumps into the tackle, maybe Kikuchi also slightly dives in, but generally speaking, it's no foul there. There's nothing there warranted. The referee gives a free kick, even though it's in the penalty area, which is the only decision it can't be. And obviously, he has to then get that reviewed because it's clearly not a free kick. They have to look at the penalty. And I think he just says, well, I've already given it Kashiwa's way. It's in the area. I have to give a penalty, even though to every other observer, there is nothing there at all. So, yeah, it was a very poor decision. It went against Vissel, as most things are this season, but Kashiwa took advantage and didn't really look back from then on.
Well, yeah, I mean, just really head-scratching and hugely unfortunate for Kobe on the penalty. As you say, just a tangle of legs, basically, Kikuchi and Toshima. And, well, yeah, it took 5 minutes to finally get settled before Matteo Savio scored the penalty to put Reysol in front at half-time. And then, well, yeah, the killer third for the hosts came from the substitute Yuki Muto, who had only been on the pitch for 2 minutes when he chested down and lashed across Daya Maekawa and in off his left-hand post in the 65th minute. But, well, yeah, to say it wasn't Kobe's day is a massive understatement. They thought they had pulled the goal back with 14 minutes to go. Yoshinori Muto tucking home, but VAR noticed that the ball had crossed the end line before Koya Yuruki got to it to cross for Yuya Osako, who spun it back for Muto. So Kobe, well, what can you say that hasn't been said already this season, Sam? It's just been an absolute horror show, well, from start to finish, basically. As we're going to come on to, the wins for S-Pulse and Belmare above them have them now well and truly cut adrift, 5 points behind those two teams in 16th and 17th respectively, and a full 6 points from safety as we reach the halfway point of the season. Daniel Hawkins, very much tongue-in-cheek, but I like the question enough that we'll have to raise it. Daniel says that Sento Kuore Harima from Hyogo had a 1-0 win on Saturday, and they haven't lost a game this season as they sit top of the Kansai Soccer League. Should Vissel turn their focus to being the number one team in their prefecture rather than number one in Asia? And if you're a Kobe fan, I think you just have to take that on the chin, don't you, Sam? It's just been a horror show for them so far, and it's up to them to turn it around. We know they've got the names, we know they've got the talent, but whether they can put it together in the second half of the season, well, it's going to be one of the major things that we're going to be watching for, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, but I don't think they've got much hope in their prefecture either. They're nowhere near Ainak Kobe at the moment. So, yeah, just concentrate on just being better than Shonan and Shimizu, I think, is the way they need to go. And, yeah, it will be an interesting summer. They obviously have a lot of money. A few weeks ago, they had a supporters meeting. They tried to address some concerns in that. They were promised that there would be investment in the squad this summer. They've been linked with a lot of players already. Your Maya Yoshida's... Suzuki, I think, is the former Sapporo striker. He's also been linked. They're bound to be linked with various others as well. I think Hiroki Abe, the former Kashima player who's had an injury hit spell at Barcelona. So they're going to throw money at it. They're going to try and do everything they can to get out of it. Just, yeah, will they be able to? It's a difficult game at the weekend against Urawa. They could find themselves even more adrift, even before this transfer window comes in yet. So it's going to be a really fascinating period with Kobe. They are obviously looking at the team. It looks far too good to go down, but that is clearly not the case ever in any league. No team is too good to go down. And I'm still living for the time when Iniesta plays J2 football. But yeah, maybe just a pipe dream.
Well, on the similar lines, that's a perfect setup for Victor Arroyo's question. Victor was, got his questions in at the 11th hour. He wondered whether he was too late or not. But Victor, after your star turn on extra time a couple of weeks ago, there's no way I could refuse to get your questions in. So Victor wonders, if Kobe goes down to J2, do you think Iniesta will stay or just retire? Obviously, it's your dream to see him in the second tier. So fingers crossed that, he'll carry on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was great. I mean, it was not at the peak of his powers, was he, Diego Forlan, when he dropped into J2 and played a few months with Cerezo Osaka. So I would hope that Iniesta would probably play a little bit there. He's still contracted, of course, so he's not got that easy out. And I don't see him wanting to retire and end his illustrious career with a J1 relegation to his name. So, yeah, I could see him going back to Spain somewhere, maybe in some sort of role at Barcelona. They welcomed back Dani Alves a couple of years back, so maybe they'd do the same for Iniesta. So I don't think he would retire on the back of a relegation with Kobe, but I really hope we see him maybe for a couple of months in J2. That would be the ideal scenario, and then he'd probably leave after that.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, well, thanks, Victor. And a couple more questions from him coming later on as well. So, for Raysol, a first three-game winning streak of the season as they continue to fly high in fourth spot in the table. Also on the back of three straight wins now are Sanfrecce Hiroshima, who edged their way up to fifth after a come-from-behind home victory over Cerezo Osaka. Bruno Mendes gave Cerezo the lead 9 minutes into the second half when he got across his man and met Hirotaka Tamede's cross with a fine header past Keisuke Osako. A minute later, Sanfrecce striker Nassim Ben Khalifa netted, only for the goal to be disallowed when VAR noted he was offside when Shunki Higashi headed across the box into his path. But it was worth the wait when Hiroshima finally equalised with 12 minutes left. Gakuto Notsuda sending a 25-yard rocket whistling across Kim Jin-hyun and into the net for 1-1. And then 5 minutes later, Douglas Vieira was upended by Matej Jonic in the box, and the big man stepped up and fired home the spot kick himself to win it for Hiroshima and, yes, send them above their visitors and, as I said, up to fifth in the table. So, I guess some thoughts on this game in its entirety, Sam, but also we've got a number of questions from our patrons wondering about just how high Sanfrecce can go this year.
Yeah, well, this was a very good game. I think it was the game that you highlighted, or at least one of them coming into the round. Two teams in good form, two teams just on the outskirts of the ACL places, and they both gave it as good as they got in this game. I thought Cerezo were maybe started out the better team. They obviously took the lead, but also had a very good chance from Mike Kuma when he headed over from 2 yards. Mm. But Sanfrecce responded really well. They were so quick to get that goal that was just offside, and after the game Michael Skiver said that this was their best performance, and I think he is more talking about the response to going behind the response to adversity, and they really did play well. That it took a very good goal to break down Cereza, who traditionally a very good defensive team, and they were holding them quite well. So it took a bit of a wonder strike, really, from Notsada, who is another player that has been revitalised this season. He's never really made it into this Hiroshima team previously, so many loan spells, but he's looked at home in midfield and he's got a reward here. It's a terrific strike to beat Kim, who is a very good goalkeeper, had previously produced that save against Higashi in the first half, which was a really good effort. So yeah, great goal this from Hiroshima, and then they just kept going after that. Forced a rare error from Jonic. It's a poor tackle as he dives in. And yeah, they got their winner 2-1. They're still right there. Well, they're 6 points off third, still with a game in hand. They're definitely putting themselves in the mix at the moment. Them and Kasia, I think, are the basis of a couple of questions. I'm sorry, you'll have to remind me who asked them. But they're there or thereabouts, aren't they? You've got the three in the top three at the moment. They're all very good size, but they've all got their flaws. You can see where all three of them could drop points. And if everything goes perfectly for Kashua and for Hiroshima, based on how they've played so far this season, then it's not impossible that they have a run towards a title, or at least a push for that. The only thing I would have with both sides is I think they lack in squad depth. As I've said many times with Reysol, if you take out Koga, Savio, Koyamatsu and maybe Hosoya now, I think without that, there is a limited amount of quality, especially coming in behind them. And Hiroshima are the same. It's still a very average level squad that has been boosted by the tactics and a few players bursting onto the scene this season. But still, you take out one or two from that. And whether that is a Morishima potentially going in the summer, whether you take out Mr. Shiotani, I think then they become quite weak after that. So I think, in a perfect world, they have a chance, but I just think squad depth is going to limit them, and maybe they're fighting over that potential fourth place in the ACL, depending on Emperor's Cup winners.
Well, yeah, we got a total of three on Hiroshima, and all were along similar lines, from Pudini, from Daniel Hawkins, and from Victor. Victor, how realistic is Sanfrecce getting a top four spot? Daniel and Pudini wondering about the title. Yes, they've dropped the T word. And it's something that I think we've begun to entertain the thought of as well, isn't it, as they've edged their way up the table. But yeah, you do slightly worry for them over the course of the summer with so many games and the schedule slightly more compact than a normal J1 campaign. But they've gotten themselves into this position thanks to the Michael Skibber revolution, and we've given him enough credit since he's come into the country. I mean, he was named the manager of the team of the half season, so there's no higher honor than that, is there, Sam? So Skibber has been absolutely terrific, and as he's the first to admit, his players have been fantastic as well, bought into his system, and they've turned into a pretty well-oiled machine. I mean, they're not the most prolific in terms of attack. And, if they ever get that sorted out, if they ever get Junior Santos into any sort of form, then look out. But, they've put together the second best defense in the league in terms of goals conceded. And, they're looking a real force to be reckoned with. I don't know at this stage whether anything is beyond them, Sam. So the guys are mentioning the title. I mean, sure, there. I think we've seen enough flaws in the teams above them to suggest that, if they win their game in hand, they'll be level with Reysol and they'll be only 4 points off the top. So, the sky is definitely the limit for this team. But at the same time, I imagine that Skibber will be wanting to pump the brakes slightly on too lofty a set of expectations.
Yeah, I don't think he came in with them, what were they, second bottom. I thought it would be entertaining title suggestions later in the season. So I think, obviously, the aim has to be any good team worth their salt, when they're in fifth position, they potentially only 4 points off the top, they have to be considering a title run. And it's not like Hiroshima are a team adverse to that. They've got title pedigree in them, and if they're in with a shout towards the end of the season, then absolutely, why not? There are, in that first 11, I think there are players that can win a title. You look at the likes of Shiatane, been there, done that, Sasaki as well. They've definitely got those players that can get them over the line, but it's just the only problem I have with them is just a little bit thin on the ground. If one or two injuries, especially if they're playing through the summer, you've got the cup competitions as well, the games are going to come thick and fast, and I think those top three compared to Hiroshima and Reysol just have that ability to deal with a couple of injury crises a little bit better than these two teams. But as I say, a perfect world, if everything goes swimmingly for them, there is absolutely no reason that this team hasn't got the quality to go on and win the league this season.
Yeah, and just imagine how crazy you would have sounded if you had uttered those words around match day 5 or 6, right? But yes, it's well and truly in play for Sanfrecce now, and they'll just be hoping to ride this wave of momentum. As we said, 3 straight victories and a long unbeaten run now has got them all the way up to 5th in the table and with no signs of slowing down. But it did look a terrific game against Cerezo, who gave as good as they got, and they're still well and truly in the mix as well, despite slipping a spot down to 6th. All right, so next we'll turn our attentions to the area around the bottom of the table, just above Vissel Kobe. Well, getting a much more comfortable buffer ahead of Kobe are both Shimizu and Shonan after home victories on Saturday evening. First, we'll head to Nihon Daira, where Shimizu took care of Daniel Hawkins's Fukuoka side 3-1 in the first game of Zé Ricardo's reign as manager of Shimizu S-Pulse. It ended up being a frustrating evening for Fukuoka. It got off to a dreadful start for the visitors when Kenta Nishizawa scored the first goal of the new manager's reign in just the 7th minute with a first-time shot from Yuta Kamiya's cutback. Fukuoka did have their chances. Just 5 minutes after that, Japan goalkeeper Shuichi Gonda made a fine reflex save to keep out a Yuya Yamagishi header. And then 8 minutes before the break, Gonda leapt to tip over a Wanma header preserved S-Pulse's lead. Then 4 minutes after that, the hosts went 2-0 up when Nishizawa crossed from the right and Thiago Santana sent a brilliant header from beyond the penalty spot, flashing past Masaaki Murakami and into the net. So that was S-Pulse 2-0 up at halftime. Yamagishi, who of course has scored in both legs of the Levain Cup playoff stage win over Kashima, continued his purple patch by netting with a superb first-time shot from the edge of the box with 10 minutes to go to give Avispa some hope of snatching a point. But that hope was extinguished 5 minutes later when S-Pulse countered. Santana slipped in Benjamin Kalloli and the Kosovan international dinked over Murakami to seal the win, their first in 6 games. So we've just spoken about Hiroshima, Sam, and the new manager bounce they got after Michael Skibber was able to enter the country and get his stamp onto this club. I think it's asking a bit much for Zé Ricardo to do the same, and he's only got half a season, obviously, to work with his S-Pulse side, but all you can do is start with a win, and that's what he was able to do.
Oh, absolutely. It was a perfect first game for him. I think he tried a few different things. Not the system was quite similar, but generally he's favoured really quick wingers and really tricky wingers. And Nishizawa, who has been criminally underused for the last couple of years, he got his start and he performed really well, got his goal, got the assist for Santana. He brought back Yuta Kamiya, who I've really wanted to play in this team and who's not played for the last however many games, not to my delight, but yeah, he was also very well involved, and Shimizu looked a really good attacking force. And when you've got Thiago Santana up front and you create chances for him, then he's going to score goals. So I really liked what I saw from Shimizu here. Yes, it's the first game, it's the old new manager bounce that almost every team except for Vissel Kobe seems to get. So I'm officially back on the bandwagon. I didn't really want to jump off it, but I am back on it now. I really liked it. There are still issues at the back that he's going to have to deal with, but I think he's, from the face of it and from what I've gathered from various people that have followed his career, he's not going to be one of these where, like, you what Shimizu went with, where they went full one way with Klimovsky and then full the other way with Lotina, he's more balanced than that. He's going to sort the defence out, he's going to look after that, but he still wants to play good flowing attacking football without being ridiculous about it, without over risking anything. So it looks like the perfect profile of manager to sort of get the best out of this Shimizu team. There are definitely players there. I think Matsuoka will come back into the team after the under-21s. And yeah, I think he's the manager that can harness it, or at least it looked like it from this first game. They really played well. They created too many chances, especially against an Avispa team that doesn't concede many goals. To start off with 3 goals in that game, I think it's a perfect way to go. So I like the signs. And yeah, just looking at the table, I mean, it's not like that it's a massive gap there. They have to bridge. They can win two or three games and suddenly find themselves in mid-table. So yeah, I think the signs are positive for Shimizu. And yeah, I think if you're looking at Gamba, if you're looking at other teams in that mid-table, I think you've got to be a little bit worried now.
Right. Well, this might be a good time to ask the last of Harry Brooks's questions then, Sam, because we've just spoken about Fukuoka, and obviously we don't want to add to the disappointment from Fukuoka supporters about this defeat on Saturday. But Harry is wondering, and yeah, in the cluster of teams from 9th to 15th currently, that is for listeners who don't have the table in front of them, is Kyoto 9th on 20 points, down to Gamba in 15th on 17, so just 3 points between them. Who are you most concerned about dropping into the bottom 3 that is currently occupied by Shimizu, Shonan and Kobe? Harry says Sapporo and Avispa worry him for opposite reasons. One of them conceding too many goals, i.e. Sapporo, and the other not scoring enough, referring to Avispa. So from Kyoto, again, listeners don't have the table in front of them, so from 9th to 15th is Kyoto, Nagoya and Sapporo all on 20 points. Fukuoka have 19, Reds and Iwata have 18, and Gamba has 17. So we spoke about Gamba earlier on with the first game we reviewed, Sam. So they obviously have serious concerns. But of these teams, yeah, which one are you the most concerned about?
Oh, it's difficult to pick one. I agree with the points on Sapporo. They always worry me. They're defensively shambolic and will get themselves into trouble. But I think they've got enough goals to see them out of it. Avispa are a concern because they don't score too many. It doesn't look like they're going to create too many goals either. They've just, you know, maybe Lukian will put them in. Maybe he'll gather some form at some point, but they have to be concerning. I would put Kyoto ahead of them as my main concern there, because they started the season so well, where Cho managed to figure out the opposition. He then created tactics that were confusing the opposition. They couldn't really get to grips with it. But since then, they've been on a terrible run of form. They don't really look like hurting too many teams. They look like they're easily get-at-able as well. Kashima's created so many good chances in that game. They could have scored two or three more quite easily. So yeah, Kyoto at the moment I think are the biggest concern for me, because if you look at the other teams where you think Gamba have got the players, they can probably get out of it. Jubilo, I still think they're quite a poor team, but they generally just have that ability to hang in games, and more so than Kyoto. Reds will buy their way out of it in the summer, and Nagoya have the players and they could probably buy themselves out of it in the summer as well. So yeah, Kyoto would be my biggest concern. Avispa have to be a concern because they just don't score goals. And Sapporo, I hope they're not a concern, but they're frustratingly probably going to be for the season. So yeah, Kyoto, I'm afraid, are my biggest worry there.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo the thoughts on Avispa and their lack of goals. But again, I support the team who Fukuoka scored 5 against this season, and 5 of their 12 league goals came in that one game. So it sounds a bit silly if I throw them into the fire. But yeah, I'm sure Daniel and other Fukuoka supporters would echo the concerns that, yeah, the lack of goals is hugely worrying, but they have to have faith in the players that they've got in attacking positions, I think. I mean, not only Yamagishi, who's been carrying the load in recent times, but yeah, you have to factor in a purple patch or two for the likes of Wanma and Lukian over the next few months will hopefully right the ship for Fukuoka. And I guess for me it's the easiest answer, but because they're the closest to the bottom three at the moment. But yeah, I don't see an enormous amount of light at the end of the tunnel for Gumba. They do have good players, but I mean, yeah, most of the teams around them have good players as well, and yeah, it's just going to take something for them to dig themselves out. And again, it might just be a good run of form, two or three wins on the spin, and life will be good again. But yeah, as it stands at the moment, Gumba, yeah, they're obviously looking over their shoulder after Saturday's results, and yeah, they're going to have to really knuckle down and get some results on the board, because it's as we've said throughout the first half of the year, it's just shaping as another lost campaign for them. So food for thought there. Really interesting question, Harry. And obviously the logjam in mid-table is fascinating, and there'll be a lot of musical chairs, I think, throughout the second half of the season. Not quite in mid-table, but basically 9 points off the top and 9 points off second from bottom are my side at FC Tokyo after Saturday's trip to Shonan. I should say, Sam, I was obviously really looking forward to the occasion, to the game, the one game of the season I'm definitely allowed out for. I might be able to negotiate one or two later on in the year, but you never know. Obviously checked the weather reports throughout the week, and the forecast was good right up until Saturday morning, when it decided that a thunderstorm would pass through. So we did manage to get to the park, Hiratsuka Central Park, early enough. The 2 hours before the game were absolutely terrific, catching up with some old friends and sampling the wares on offer there. Unfortunately, at about 6 o'clock, the rain started and the football started, and from there my afternoon and evening went a bit downhill as Shonan ultimately ran out fully deserved 2-0 victors. And I don't know, for Tokyo, it's a little bit like we spoke about with Japan last week, Sam. One step forward and two steps back over the course of this international break. I mean, Tokyo went into the break on the back of two straight wins, the last of them, of course, against Kashima, the then leaders. We played them off the park and won 3-1. And then with 3 weeks to prepare for the team second from bottom, just did not turn up at all. And were frankly dreadful. And as I say, hopefully not taking anything away from Shonan, who deserved to win and did so, 2-0.
Yeah, it was a very disappointing performance from Tokyo. I'm glad you enjoyed the first 2 hours at least, because there wasn't much for you to enjoy, unfortunately. Once the game kicked off, Tokyo reverted back to kind of the way they'd been playing at the start of May, including that Avispa 5-1 that you mentioned earlier, and completely against what was we saw against Shimizu and Kashima. It was too easy, I thought, for Shonan to get possession in between midfield and defence. Machino dropped in, just Sagawa got into those positions, and there wasn't really a great deal of pressure, I didn't think, on that, which is unlike the FC Tokyo under Pucci, where he wants to press up. And then once you had the ball again, you just, as it was at the start of May and probably through April as well, you had possession but didn't really look like you were going to create anything. I think Diego's season has continued to kind of stall, and bar the odd burst from Adelton, there's not really a great deal of promise in those attacks. Leandro was back off the bench but not really fit and didn't really do much either. So yeah, it was a generally quite disappointing performance. I think what I would say, and I will say it rather than you saying it, so it's not like sour grapes or anything, but I thought the Shonan first goal should have been ruled out, because I think Machino handballs it, and then it goes on. There's a bit of play before Ikeda chips the ball over Slovic, but I think the Machino handball quite clearly leads into the passage of play that Shonan score from. So I think there's a little bit of a gripe there, but that shouldn't take away from the fact that I thought Shonan were generally the better team through the 90 minutes.
Yeah, well, I do appreciate you saying that because, yeah, at the time, you know, watching on from the stands, we weren't sure, but you could definitely tell Tokyo players stopped and yeah, we're expecting a whistle. And obviously in this day and age, it's up to the referee's discretion whether he blows up straight away or he lets play go on and then it lets VAR have a look at it later. But yeah, surely, having seen a replay myself later on, it did appear that there was a handball in the build-up, but it was basically, yeah, from about the 10th minute or so on, it was pretty much all Shonan. And as you say, apart from the odd burst from Adalton, it didn't look like Tokyo were ever going to score. And, well, yeah, Belmare wrapped up the points. The first goal had come just before the half hour through Ikeda. But then, yeah, Belmare manager Satoshi Yamaguchi brought Wellington and Tarik El-Yunusi off the bench in the 68th minute. So, yeah, two positive substitutions with his side 1-0 up. But just 2 minutes later, his main man, Shuto Machino, continued his terrific recent scoring run by heading home a corner at the near post, his sixth goal in his last six league games. And, well, we were talking about players that might get called up for the EAFF squad last week, Sam. I wonder if Machino is working his way into Hajime Moriyasu's thoughts for that squad. I mean, you know, he might get squeezed out numbers wise, but I mean, he's into the top five scorers in J1 this season now with that goal. I mean, fair play to him. He gets through a power of work in his time on the pitch. And yeah, I mean, he's, you know, he's not the flashiest, obviously, but he's getting the rewards for his hard work, and this was a terrific header to ultimately wrap up the points for Shonan.
Yeah, it really was, and that's the thing about him. He scores so many different types of goals as well. He's not like a one-trick pony at all. And to score seven goals in a Shonan team doesn't create too many chances, or hasn't this season, I think full credit to him. And I think we've got a question about who might be the Golden Boot winner, but he's putting himself in there. If, as the questioner did ask, Ayas Ueda does leave for Europe, he's definitely in there and definitely should be in consideration for this EAF Cup squad. I think if you're looking at it, you'd probably go Osaka and Muto would probably get in, and you'd say Yuma Suzuki and probably Ueda if he's still there. So, as you say, he might be edged out, but he's doing himself no harm at all, is he, with his performances? Yeah, just, and generally all round his ability, as I said, he was dropping deep as well. It's not like he's just focused on scoring goals. He provides a lot in the build-up to play as well. So, yeah, he's done himself no harm and was another terrific performance from him.
Yeah, most definitely. So, yeah, well done to Shonan. It's a third win in four games for them. And, they've hung on to Shimizu's coattails, and those two teams moved on to 16 points. They're now just at one behind Gamba. And, we just talked about the logjam between Kyoto and Gamba in 15th. Well, that obviously just a further point back to those two teams now. So, they have the chance to move out of the bottom three and indeed zip up the table if other results go in their favour as well over the next couple of weeks. For Tokyo, again, I mean, you know, frustration for me in this one game here that I can get to is just such a shame that they put on such a terrible performance after, as I said, 3 weeks to prepare for this this opponent. And obviously it's hard to keep momentum going after a 3 week break, even though you've hopefully trying to keep the good times rolling after beating the team that was top of the table before the international break. And who should come next on the schedule for Tokyo than Tosu away? We mentioned it earlier in the season that the Tosu are definitely FC Tokyo's bogey team. And sifting through the stats again today, it was it was mind-boggling, basically. Tokyo have lost the last six league meetings with Tosu and have won only one of the last 14. Indeed, they have not won down in Tosu since 2015. And today, Sam, June the 20th, as we record, is the 7th anniversary of our last league win at Tosu. So, yeah, the club have a commemorative T-shirts on sale online. And, well, yeah, hopefully we can notch a first league win in 7 years down there on Sunday. But, again, sorry if I've taken anything away from Seanan here. They deserve all the credit in the world. And, yeah, they've given themselves a real chance with so many games still to be played, obviously, of, yeah, working their way out of the drop zone. Okay, well, we might have buried the lead in this episode, Sam, but as we move on to the next game, Iwata 3, Tosu 1, I think we might have just seen one of the most bizarre goals that either of us have ever seen that opened the scoring in this game in just the 8th minute. Yeah, I'm a little bit rattled after just having to talk about FC Tokyo. So would you mind trying to talk the listeners through what happened as a Tosu shaped to take a corner in the 8th minute?
I can try. I've not really recovered from watching it myself, to be honest. But yeah, Tosu win a corner in the 8th minute and they just go out to take it. Iwasaki picks the ball up, puts it down on the in the D there. I think he walks past it. Maybe he steps on it, maybe whatever. But he goes to receive the ball from Horigome, who's going to take the corner. Uehara decides to come up, just boots the ball at Horigome, comes away with it, sets up and yeah, clears the ball upfield. And that is allowed to continue. That is apparently allowed to be a corner for Sagan Tosu. It doesn't really make sense to me. The referee, Mr. Nishimura, obviously just allows play on here. I've never seen anything like it. But from that point, Uehara launches forward. Park obviously is on the halfway line as he tries to intercept. He gives it away to Ricardo Grassa. First time ball up to Fabian Gonzalez. He takes a quite a heavy touch, but straight towards goal, wins the foot race and slides the ball in. It is, it has absolutely everything, this goal, but the corner that led to it is baffling. And I've tried to look on social media to try and figure out if anyone knows what has happened. It just seems to be general confusion. And obviously there's nobody complaining about it in the, Kenta Kawai obviously has better things on his mind than to complain about this goal. But I watched it two or three times after you showed me at the start of this, as we started recording here. I've still not understood what's gone on.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it appears that it's okay for a defender to kick the ball against a player who's about to take a corner, and then yeah, he's just allowed to run up the pitch with it. So again, if anybody knows the full story behind this, maybe it was touched by one of the Tosu players when they were placing the ball down in the area where the corner has to be placed, and maybe the referee has deemed that is enough to be defined as taking a corner. To the rest of us, it just looks like, as we say, something that we've never seen before and has left us completely scratching our heads. But from the time Ricky Uehara dashes away with the ball, basically the Benny Hill theme should be running in the background because, true to form, Park Il-gyu is, he's standing about 40 yards out of his goal and races up to the halfway line to try to punt the ball out of danger. But then, what happens then is just absolutely astonishing. And, classic J-League, I suppose. But, started off with something truly bizarre, no question. But, Fabian Gonzalez made the most of his start, getting that goal in the 8th minute. And then just 5 minutes later, he doubled his fun after an intelligent cutback by Naoki Kanuma, who then made it to 3-0 in the 27th minute, stooping to head in Ricky Uehara's cross from 6 yards out. So Uehara was definitely busy in the first half. And Kanuma with an assist and a goal himself. Taisei Miyashiro thought he had pulled a goal back in first half stoppage time, but the goal was disallowed due to a handball. But he did finally get his goal 8 minutes after the restart when one of three halftime Sagan subs, Yuki Kakita, squared across the box for Miyashiro to tap in. But, after that bizarre start and Iwata racing into a 3-0 lead in the first half hour, Sam, I guess ultimately they've deserved it. And, a game and a goal that we'll be talking about for a long time to come, but to ultimately another precious 3 points for Iwata.
Very much so, and kind of bizarre just summed up that entire first half, because Jubilo, you didn't expect them to be 3-0 up before the half-hour mark. So, yeah, maybe the game would have changed if that goal, which I can't see why it counts, is disallowed after the Tosu corner. But from then on, I thought they played really well, Jubilo. Without Suzuki on that right-hand side, Uehara did play very well, filling in his ball in for the second goal. Very nice. I thought Kanuma played really well, and I like anyone that produces a diving header. So this was a glorious goal and another good cross from Uehara. And yeah, it was still bizarre with the Miyashiro disallowed goal, because the ball is just sliced into him, he knows nothing about it, but because it's hit his hand, it doesn't count. So they were a little bit unfortunate there. They played slightly better Tosu in the second half once they got back to 3-1, but Jubilo were reasonably good defensive outfit, especially when they had the lead that they did. They sat in quite well. They didn't really concede too many open spaces for Tosu to work in after that 3-1 goal. And maybe they probably went the closest, actually, with Jermaine as he turned and shot just wide. So all in all, a really good performance from Iwata. It gives them a small buffer now to the it gets them above Gamba Osaka, so they're the buffer for them. And yeah, it's a disappointing result from Tosu. They didn't really play too well, and I'm not gonna bring them into the midfield mess at the moment. They've still got a decent gap, but yeah, good performance from Iwata.
Yeah, fair enough then. So, fourth win of the season for Iwata. Obviously, some pundits had them rock bottom in their J Preds, and obviously they could still end up finishing there. But yeah, four wins is through the first half of the season is well, obviously they would have preferred to get more, but I think overall, considering how they were expected to fare, it's a reasonable enough return, and within touching distance of mid table is a reasonable enough position for them at the halfway stage. Probably not the best time to answer this question, rather, after a disappointing Tosu performance and a 3-1 away defeat. But Victor's third question was on Tosu, and it is an interesting one. They are by far the smallest club in J1. So Victor wonders, how have Tosu been able to stay in J1 for so long, even as in inverted commas, smaller club? So, basically they came up with FC Tokyo and Sapporo at the end of the 2011 J2 season. And they've been in J1 ever since. And they've had several narrow escapes, but they've also had seasons where they've finished comfortably in the top half of the table. So they are a fascinating club, and I guess, well, as I outlined earlier, the stats when they play FC Tokyo, the fact that they get to play Tokyo twice a year certainly aids them in being able to stay in the division. But I think while we certainly know there are a number of financial concerns, and there have been over the past few seasons, Sam, about the overall viability of the club. I mean, the way that they've been able to manage their resources, and well, I mean, it's almost been a turnstile the way they've had to get rid of players, isn't it, in the last year and a half or so. But the way they've been able to bring players through and then regenerate is it's fascinating, really, the way they've been able to do it, considering the budget, the size of the club and their catchment area. I mean, it's a massive credit the way the club is run, I guess, is a slightly different matter. But on the pitch, the football department definitely deserve a tons of credit for the way they've gone about things.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the pitch, it's been a constant evolution. I mean, when I first started watching the J-League, I think Tosu actually were in a title race in 2014, but they were kind of that functional side where you've got Toyota up front and they weren't very nice to play against. They'd get in your faces. They'd be one of those, like, yeah, just a nuisance, a really difficult team to play against. And then they had that period under Ficadenti where they're going to be quite well organised. They weren't ever at the heights that they are, well, they have been the last couple of seasons or in that fourth place, but they were still a really difficult team to beat. But then, yeah, the problems started coming in. They started losing they brought in Torres and all that nonsense, and things were starting to go wrong off the field. So they were struggling, but they managed to bring in Kim Mung-hee, obviously slightly disgraced now, but a very good manager in that he rescued them a few times. And then he was able to kind of revolutionise the team each season when they kept losing players. He was the one that was bringing the players through the youth. He was seemed to get the best out of these players, obviously not necessarily by the greatest means, but it was working. They went away from him, had a horrible little period with Luis Carreras, which was, you know, he didn't get the best out of the little he had. But again, Kim came and kind of saved that situation again. And now they lose so many players each season. But for him, and now Kenta Kawaya's done the same. And they might be that they've got a little bit in place behind, like the scouting network must be pretty decent. And they have the ability to take players that are kind of unheralded, but they just fit the system and they just perfectly fit the way that Kawhi as it is now wants to play. And that's what they do. They just cherry pick little players that no one else is that interested in, it seemingly. Like, take a Horigome, who was on the bench for Jeff United for most of last season, barely getting a look in, but he just fit the way Kawhi wanted to play, and that's what they've done. And it has worked really well. I don't know how long that could continue. There are only so many times you can just shake the bag and just lie it out and you've got a wonderful set of players that really work. So I don't know how long it's going to last for, but they have just performed so well above their means. And it is great to see. Obviously, this isn't the game to really talk about that after a poor performance. But yeah, fantastic. But I think, although he's obviously there are issues there, I think a lot of credit has to go to Kim Young-hui, who really saved this team on a couple of occasions. And if it wasn't for him, they'd have been in J2 a long while ago.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic story. And just the basic achievement of being able to stay in the league for a decade, considering the state of the club at certain times and the resources, as we said, they've got at their disposal is a credit. And a really interesting question, Victor. Thanks for that. But yeah, as we said, yeah, just slightly disappointing performance from Sagan on Saturday. All right, so the last game left to review then was played out in front of the biggest crowd of the match day of just under 29,000 at Saitama Stadium. It saw Urawa host Nagoya, two underachieving, in inverted commas, big clubs throughout the first half of the season, both in the bottom half of the table. And along similar lines to Iwata, who made an early burst and got their three goals, quick smart against Tosu. Reds did similarly against Nagoya. It took them slightly longer to get going, but ultimately three goals in 15 minutes did for Grampus. The first two came within 2 minutes of each other, and in almost identical fashion, the first in the 21st minute when Alex Schultz headed in a Ken Iwao corner from inside the six-yard box. And then, yes, just 2 minutes later, another in-swinging corner from the left from Iwao was flicked on at the near post. And Atsuki Ito, one of my favourites, tapped in at the far post from a yard out for his first league goal of the season. Ito then turned provider 9 minutes before halftime, playing a 1-2 with Takehiro Sekine, who then tucked home a neat finish past Yohei Takeda, with Mitch Langerak still absent, injured for Nagoya. So it stayed 3-0 despite the best efforts of Mateus, who was obviously front and centre with everything Nagoya were trying to do offensively. But it could have even been better for Reds, who hit the woodwork twice in second half stoppage time. But ultimately, Sam, a convincing and, at the end of the day, a much needed victory for Reds to hopefully kickstart some momentum in the second half of the season for them.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the two goals coming from corners, that doesn't really necessarily mean that the team have played that well. I think they're pretty poor. Yeah. Like the defending from Nagoya, I mean, you'd never see this last season. I don't know what's happened, but they had Leo Silva marking Alex Schultz, which was a dreadful decision from whoever decided that. Schultz easily peeled away from Leo Silva to head in. And then, the second one, nobody is marking Ito. And I know I've seen this routine from Reds a few times this season, but it looks like nobody at Nagoya was paying any attention. They got completely caught out by it. It's a good move, and Ito scores. And then on, yeah, it wasn't a great game of football, I don't think. There was a bit of quality for the third goal. Ito, your favourite, yeah, with a really nice reverse pass into Sekine. But then the second half, Reds obviously were 3-0. They don't need to do anything more at that point. They still were the better team and had chances, as you mentioned, off the crossbar and off the post. But Nagoya, yeah, didn't really look like creating too much. That obviously, when you put all your eggs in the Mateus basket, if he's not firing, then that squad isn't firing. And they got the result they deserved for that. And yeah, it's just really poor. I just don't like the Hasegawa team at all. He's taken away the main good thing of the Fikadenti team in that solid defence and made them unable to defend set pieces, basically, and not really improve the attack. It's still just Mateus, and yeah, they're not really going to go anywhere, and I'm sure they'll sort themselves out. They've got the resources to do so. They've got the players in the squad too. But yeah, they're in that mid-table malaise at the moment. And there's every chance, if they keep playing like this, that they get dragged into a relegation battle.
Yeah, there's a lot of traffic around them, isn't there? And yeah, it wouldn't take more than, you know, two or three losses on the spin for them to start to slide down the table. So yeah, a disappointing disappointing evening for Grampus, but for Reds, as we said, a much needed win. I should clarify, Ito is still very much in the friend zone, but yes, yeah, I'm quite a fan, so we'll see if that blossoms in the future. But for Reds, yeah, just a third league win of the season, but it moves them on to 18 points. And yes, along with Iwata, they moved above Gumba in this match day. So all right then, that's our 9 games from match day 17 reviewed, as we have reached the halfway point of the season. As Neil mentioned earlier on, we were talking about Kawasaki. Frontale are in Emperor's Cup action this Wednesday night. Indeed, all 18 J1 clubs have made it through to the third round of the Emperor's Cup, or in tennis terms, the round of 32 of the competition. There are two all J1 ties on the slate. Shimizu host Kyoto, and Shonan welcome Iwata to the Lemon Gas Stadium in a matchup of J1 match day 17 winners. And then we should say that, yeah, almost all of the J1 clubs are listed as the home team, but play away to either J2 or J3 opposition in the Emperor's Cup third round. So the possibility for cup sets slightly elevated by the fact that almost all of the J1 clubs are playing away from home. So then to the weekend's match day 18, there are 3 games on Saturday, and they all hold their own levels of intrigue. And maybe I shouldn't spoil them, because Sam might want to mention them in his picks of the weekend, with the other 6 games being played on Sunday. So, Sam, I don't know if you want to pick out a game for each of the 2 days of the weekend, or if you just want to plump for one main event. But, what is Sam's pick of the weekend?
Sam's pick of the weekend.
Yeah, I'll go for 2. I think the first game of the weekend, Marinos versus Reysol, I think that's a really exciting one. Obviously, Kasia are performing well above expectations. This is a real difficult game for Marinos, and it's one that they struggled with earlier in the season. Yes, there was a red card in there, but Kasia really caused them problems and got that victory. So, yeah, let's see if Marinos have learnt anything from that. I think it should be a really exciting game. And, 2 teams in good form. And then 2 teams not always in good form. I think for Sunday, Kobe versus Reds has to be the game I pick out. I think that looks a real cracker. Reds obviously coming off the back of a very good 3-0 victory, good result-wise. Can they then put real pressure on Kobe? If they lose this one, they're in real trouble at the bottom of the table, if they're not already. But on the other flip side, if Kobe can beat a team like Urawa, obviously it brings them into trouble, but it gives them a potential boost as well. And just, there's so many good players that haven't really performed so far this season, but on their day, this could prove to be a really exciting match. And I believe it was the return fixture earlier in the season. It was one of those midweek rounds. It was a really exciting game. So hopefully the same here. But yeah, those would be my 2 picks. I really didn't want to pick the Tosu Tokyo one for you.
Well, yes, thank you for not picking Tosu's home win over FC Tokyo. I very much appreciate that. But echo your thoughts there. They look the pick of both days over the weekend. But yeah, so many interesting looking games. I tell you what, I had Hiroshima Cerezo this past weekend. So how about Cerezo Shimizu on Sunday? That could be it could be an interesting one. Yeah, Cerezo looking to bounce back after their defeat at the hands of Sanfrecce. Of course, they'd won three on the spin before that. And then, yes, can the Zé Ricardo new manager bounce continue for S-Pulse when they travel to the Yodoko Stadium? We shall see. But as always, yeah, expect the unexpected and expect goals that you've never seen and should almost certainly be disallowed because, yeah, this is the J-League and, yeah, that's why we love it. So another bumper episode, to put it mildly, but obviously great to catch up with Neil again. And, yes, we always like to take our time working our way through all these games, don't we, Sam? So yeah, we'll regroup and yeah, wonder what's going to happen in the Emperor's Cup. I'm sure the Extra Time boys will be across any cup sets later on in the week, and then yes, we'll reconvene after yeah, match day 18 is played over the weekend.
Yeah, look forward to it. It's a really exciting round of Emperor's Cup fixtures. I do quite like this. This is why the Louvain Cup should be knockout football. It should be an exciting Wednesday and, yeah, a good set of fixtures this weekend. Apologies to anyone if my connection has been dreadful throughout this episode. It's been cutting in and out all game. So apologies to you, Ben, if it ruins you in the editing room. But hopefully everything comes out okay.
No worries, mate. Yeah, I didn't notice too many things this time around, so I'm sure we'll be okay and everything will stitch together nicely. So yeah, great to catch up with you again, Sam. And yeah, a few thank yous as we exit this episode. A big thanks to our newest patron, Nick T, for jumping on board over the course of the past week, and of course to all of our questioners on this episode. They all answered the call, and yeah, we very much appreciate their input to the episode. So to Pudini, to Harry, to Daniel, Naoya, Johnny, Kang, and Victor, and to Andre, who I've just noticed on my phone has tried to send a message, and I haven't been able to get back to you, Andre. So we were in the recording room while your message came through. So apologies about that. Listeners, obviously, it goes without saying, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. And we'll be back next week to review J1 Match Day 18. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.